Well, it's recording. I guess that means I have to say something entertaining and relevant.
With wit and charisma.
We are recording this episode on April 23rd, which is 4 short days before the release of Avengers Infinity War, which, in many ways, is arguably the single most important geek slash nerd film event of all time. Would you say that's fair, sir?
I mean, it's 10 years of buildup to this, just within the Marvel Cinematic Universe, to say nothing of, you know, superhero movies and comic book movies and everything else that have been made over the years. This has been a huge and actually quite daring undertaking by Marvel Studios to make this happen.
Yeah, I mean, not entirely sure exactly when the original Infinity War storyline in the comics happened. Maybe the 90s or late 80s?
I think it was in the 80s.
So let's say it was the 80s. And if you've been following that specific story from its inception, you know, you've been waiting 25, 30 years to kind of see something like a movie version brought to reality.
For the record, it was 1992.
Okay, so still 26 years.
Yeah.
The better part of 30 years. And that's just for the Infinity War storyline. I mean, if you've been a fan, let's say you started out as a 10-year-old, you know, in the 60s when all these characters were created. I'm just growing up before the proliferation of superhero movies ourselves, we were part of that generation that could kind of stay up all night going, well, what if, you know, so-and-so fought this guy, and, you know, wow, wouldn't it be cool to see that in a movie, and that kind of discussion, it's real now.
Yep.
So, I mean, yeah, it's been 10 years just building up to this point in the current Marvel, you know, cinema universe, cinematic, the official title, whatever. But, you know, the Marvel movies.
Sure.
But we're talking, you know, 50 years of active debate and wondering and that kind of thing, anticipation. So it's a pretty big event.
Right. And even when people realized, I think maybe for the first time, that this is the direction they were going was in 2012, because the post-credit scene at the end of the first Avengers features Thanos. And people realized,
right,
this is where they're going with this. So even from then, it's been 6 years of further building. The point you're making almost answers the question that we come into this podcast wanting to discuss, which is essentially, you know, why is it that pop culture, nerddom, fandom, geekery, dorkery, why has film kind of taken the central role in all that? And I think part of it is what you're talking about. There's been, you know, this content, this material, this storytelling has been around for a long time in a lot of different types of media. Film is sort of the last to come along. Superhero movies have been around for a long time, but we're finally at a point where they can make the stories as big as they're drawn. And maybe this is just what people have been waiting for, so that's why, you know, sort of fandom orbits around film at the moment. Or at least part of the reason.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, another aspect is that movies are one of the most accessible and you know, democratically had experienced forms of entertainment, or, you know, just ways to express an idea, period. So anytime a certain property or a certain idea kind of catches fire, there's bound to be a movie about it.
Yeah, I think it's accessible too on the part of the consumer. You know, I think if even though sort of nerd is cool now or whatever, you know, it's kind of become a cliche, I think there's still a little bit of sort of a negative connotation to people that would, you know, read comics as adults or, you know, be interested in cartoons or whatever it is. But it's become very acceptable to think that you're going to go see the superhero movie because it's a movie, and movie culture has existed separately from nerdery. And I think it comes from, actually, there's something else that I had made as a note, was there's sort of like, it's still a date culture.
Right.
People go to see these things. It's accepted. It's not sort of a niche thing anymore. So it kind of comes from that. There's no residual negative connotation that, even though it's more accepted than it ever was, people still be like, oh, you play Dungeons and Dragons? Oh, you read comics? I think there's still a little bit of that in society in general.
Yeah, I mean, especially prior to the last 20 years, I think you could kind of sum up what we're talking about as crudely as or as simply as basically the things that jocks would consider uncool. But I mean, people always point to things like comic books or science fiction as the classic examples of, you know, what nerds like. And of course there are endless variations and branches off of those main subjects that would be included as well. But one article I found by Esquire titled, "Are We All Nerds Now?" It kind of breaks it down or explains it more as the inclination to obsess about your interests. And, you know, people in general have that in common. You know, the jocks would obsess about sports stats and player names and things like that just as much as some quote-unquote nerd would obsess about collecting all the Amazing Spider-Man issues in a certain story arc or, you know, things like that.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, nobody is immune to those tendencies. And perhaps now we've reached a point where the emphasis is more on the act than the specific subject matter.
Well, there's also, things are so much more, again, I come back to the word accessible. You know, it's so much easier to sort of dive into the minutia of a given given subject matter because of the internet. You know, you can dive down the rabbit hole of a given topic and not come up for hours or days. And it doesn't matter if it's, you know, the accuracy of quarterbacks after the age of 30 in the NFL, or if it's, you know, how many superhero or comic book franchises have been led by African-American characters, which is a topic that we covered before. I mean, there is endless minutia that you can now, it's at your fingertips now. And I think so that maybe that encourages people to sort of be willing to dive in because you can just do it and you can do it on your own. You don't have to be out there showing the world what you're doing and be embarrassed by it. Even though it might not be right to be embarrassed by it, I'm not saying that that's okay. But I'm saying that it allows people the freedom to do what they want. And it's all right there on your smartphone.
Yeah. Yeah, it's minutiae and, you know, the ability to access it is certainly easier now than ever before. I don't know. I think technology plays a part in changing the landscape of so many aspects of life, not just necessarily nerdery, but
so many social conversations come to, well, there's the internet now.
Right.
It changes exactly. So much of the equation across the board.
You can't really deny its effect. I have a couple of interesting stats from that article. So there was a study, I guess, of 1,000 adults done, and it said that 87% of them say that they aren't necessarily trying to hide their geeky interests from, you know, coworkers and friends and family, like, you know, would have been done in the past. But on the same token, it says that 69% of people still consider geeks awkward. So there's a discrepancy where, you know, the formerly closeted geeks are kind of pulling away in significant numbers, but that stigma kind of still persists.
Yeah, well, that's kind of, I was kind of trying to get there earlier,
right,
when I was talking about how there is still sort of a negative thought. Maybe it's not so negative, but it's sort of a, you know, archetypal thinking where somebody who is that would exist as a certain type of person. So And it's always been frustrating to me because, you know, this is kind of a meta thing to get into, but within movies, those archetypal types of people are always very well defined. So, and even as I was growing up, I never could quite understand that because I never experienced that. You know, I was always into fantasy and sci-fi. I was never like a popular kid, but I also played sports. Right. So I didn't always understand that sort of hard delineation that is drawn. And I think it's more just sort of a psychological assumption that people make rather than an actual cultural reality.
Yeah.
And I think there's a little bit of tribalism there too, because people
definitely
they want to find their group, and they sort of they over-identify with that group. So everything they do becomes this certain type of identity. And that's not just people who would look at the geeks and look down on them. That's the geeks looking at the jocks and looking down on them because whatever they're pursuing is not as wholesome or not as good in some way as what we're doing. So I think it goes both ways. It's kind of that sort of hardwired human need to belong to a group.
Right.
And I think it kind of, it's, you know, it's in our reptilian brain. And I think that we draw that, whether it be, you know, patriotism is kind of a symptom of that. You know, I was born on this side of the border, so I connect more with the people that are on this side.
Absolutely.
Whether or not that's actually true. You know, our town is better than your town, even though both towns are exactly pretty much the same.
Right.
You know? And I think it happens on a more microcosmic level with, you know, groups of people, with, you know, small groups of people within a larger group.
Yeah. I've always really found tribalism in general to be pretty repellent. And when I say things like that, people always take it as I'm sort of positioning myself above it, even though it's this deeply embedded human response. And I don't necessarily mean to do that, but I do think that you can overcome it if you care to try. And
a little self-awareness can go a long way.
Right. It's not like, you know, even something like quitting smoking or anything on that scale. It's just, yeah, about being mindful and aware of your behavior. Not necessarily at all times, but at important times.
I think it's actually, you know, as we were sort of getting ready to talk about this subject, I found an article, and I'm going to forget the source, so I apologize. It was basically a rant of a person who is a self-proclaimed nerd who is taking such offense at other people claiming same. That, well, you look, and like literally what he was saying is that he was making these superficial judgments on people. And he criticized a couple of sort of social media nerd personalities that, well, you cannot be a nerd because look at you, you're an Adonis. You know, you're good looking, and just because you wear a Star Wars shirt and talk about nerd things nonstop doesn't make you a nerd. I'm a nerd because I was socially awkward as a kid and I played computer by myself at my house and I didn't have friends. Like, that is just as problematic. Like, I don't quite understand that resistance. It just goes back to the tribalism thing. Like, the point I'm trying to illustrate is that it's not a one-way street. It's a 8-lane highway.
Right. In a similar vein, actually a pretty old article I came across from The Guardian. It's actually from 2003. It traces it back, the popularity and the proliferation of nerd culture and the rise of the nerd, I guess, to the 70s. Like with the Woody Allen movies. Basically, he cast himself as the central figure, the hero character. But he was, you know, he played the same kind of wimpish and conventionally unattractive guy.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Thick glasses and, you know, kind of a weak constitution.
Yeah. Unsure of himself. Right. Not confident, etc.
But intelligent. So it's not hard to see that maybe as being the genesis, in at least in film. But they also kind of suggest, as we were kind of hinting at before, that it's not necessarily like your status as a nerd, for example, isn't necessarily defined by the specificity of your interest, but the intensity of it. You know, like I had said before, anybody can go off the deep end and focus in a certain area. And, you know, everybody does that. They also kind of trace it through the rise of what they call a movie brat, spearheaded by George Lucas and Steven Spielberg. They were basically film school dweebs, but they became, you know, kind of the key Hollywood billionaire figures right around the same time by making movies that were kind of in the wheelhouse of what traditional nerd interests are. Outer space and fantasy and science fiction. Then, of course, they follow it up through the 90s and early 2000s with, like we said, the internet proliferation and basically Bill Gates and Steve Jobs being the poster boys for that.
Yeah, yeah.
Classic nerds, but super powerful and super successful.
I remember a poster that was up in the wall of our high school, and it was basically a breakdown of all the money that Michael Jordan makes. It was, you know, he makes this much per minute. He makes this much per shot. He makes this much per day, you know, because of his salary at the time and all of his endorsement deals. And at the very bottom, it compared his wealth to, I think it was Bill Gates. Mm. And of course, Bill Gates, you know, has astronomically more money than Michael Jordan ever dreamed of having. And it was supposed to be an illustration of, you know, the assumption of where the money comes from, I guess. It's kind of, when you really dig too deep into that poster, it kind of becomes problematic because it's like, oh, so you're saying that, I guess, Michael Jordan he's somehow inferior because he found wealth in that way, and that's not necessarily true, et cetera.
Right.
But I remember that sort of being an interesting exposure at a young age to the concept of interests like that sort of also being able to lead you to success.
Yeah, it's, I guess, an era when things weren't necessarily talked about under such a microscope, but it's funny how you can, you know, extract information from a source like that. So I don't even remember that. I mean, I don't know if I was ever in, like, the class that you saw that in, but I don't remember seeing something like that, but it's really cool and really relevant all these years later. Now, of course, it would have to be Michael Jordan compared to Bill Gates compared to Jeff Bezos.
Oh, God, yeah. But the thing is, like, if I had the wealth of Michael Jordan, like, I would have enough.
Oh, yeah. You know, a fraction of the wealth of Michael Jordan.
Yeah, that goes into a different conversation, I guess.
Sure.
You know, the other things I have to talk about here, they don't really explain why movies have taken over this central node of sort of, you know, fandom. But I think there's symptoms of it. You know, I think the most important one is just the money the revenue that's in Hollywood. But the interesting thing that I found when I started I went into my research for this topic assuming that Hollywood revenue was going to be this sort of marker for the reason why it's so influential. But along the way, I found an interesting stat. I'm not sure what it means. We could discuss. This goes back to 2016. Hollywood revenue in 2016 was $38 billion, so it's a lot of money. It still pales in comparison to sort of major corporations, what they're able to generate as profit over the course of a year.
Right.
The video game industry that same year generated $30 billion.
Damn.
So it's just interesting, and I'm not sure, like I said, I don't know what conclusions you might draw from this, but it's interesting that, again, movies occupy this space, but there's this other media, video games, that generates almost the same sort of revenue and caters to a very similar audience.
I also found an interesting point that I feel like also relates to, I mean, it relates to the nerd interests, but also, you know, ties kind of movies and video games together. It's said in this article here from The Guardian again that the kind of nerd interests, you know, whether it's like superheroes or I guess science fiction or fantasy, are typically more inclusive than a lot of other mainstream entertainment or pastimes. You know, comic books have always been a source for strong female characters and characters of different, if not ethnicities, certainly of different, like, creatures or interstellar races.
Well, it's kind of the way that, like, you know, science fiction was always able to sort of tell socially conscious stories with the veneer of science fiction. Well,
right.
You know, we're talking about green aliens, but really we're talking about African Americans.
Yeah.
You know, so maybe at a time when trying to make that statement would not have been well received, they were still able to make it and make their point with this sort of science fiction, like I said, the science fiction gloss.
Right.
And superheroes the same way, especially, you know, especially the X-Men with the mutants thing. That's always been very analogous to inequalities of every other kind in sort of the real world.
Absolutely.
There's always connection between that and the discriminations that mutants faced in the X-Men comic books.
Kind of the same with, you know, Star Trek throughout the history of the 60s show and exactly. Next Generation and beyond. So a lot of these things are said to, you know, they appeal to women just almost as much as men, or they appeal to people of different ethnic backgrounds. It's a much more kind of universally accessible, I guess, form of entertainment. So when they finally reach movie form, all of these demographics coming together want to see this thing, as opposed to like the latest shoot 'em up, you know, hardcore action movie that surely is going to have a wide audience, but also a very specific wide audience, as opposed to something like, you know, one of these topics we've been discussing where people from all walks of life can, you know, see it and find something for themselves in it.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I hadn't really thought of it that way. It's kind of like everything's like it's taken decades, but it's all kind of funneling to this point.
Right.
Or over the years, it's been building up and all the sort of the maybe limited and maybe not quite adequate diversity that you see in these kinds of properties that we're talking about has still been more and better than what you would have seen outside of it.
Right.
So it still has drawn more people to it because they can find themselves there. And so now here we are, and that's been building up for decades and decades. And so it's amassing, and it has attracted the largest possible audience from different walks of life.
Yeah. I mean, just look at, you know, the world before like Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter, for example. Suddenly you have, you know, again, people from kind of late childhood all the way up to as old as you can go and still go to the movies that are interested in things like Lord of the Rings. And Harry Potter caught on surely with kids at first, but I mean, there are people of all ages who read those books and were interested, and it was kind of more entire family appeal.
Right.
So,
yeah.
You know, that's instead of buying your kid a ticket and dropping them off, or maybe just one parent going with a kid, you had, you know, the whole family is buying tickets, and suddenly your profits are exponentially larger.
I think it is more cross-generational too now because, you know, and this is maybe a whole other topic, but, you know, the pop culture of the 80s is maybe sort of like the strongest influencer over the last few decades. You know, whether it be cartoons, toys, video games, movies, so much came out of that. So there's a generation of people who are now parents where they're as interested in these things as their kids are. Like, there's a generation of adults who haven't just assumed they had to leave these things behind in order to lead a productive adult life. Like, you can actually do both.
Right.
And maybe it's just some sort of enlightenment that people have come to. Like, I don't know if you can point to a specific reason why that happened. But maybe it was just so cool that you don't want to leave it behind. Because, you know, Transformers are just way cooler than Stretch Armstrong. So, you want to you continue to think that it's cool even as you get to an adult. So, maybe that's part of it, too. It's more cross-generational because the adult generation who grew up, you know, in the 80s is as interested in these things as their children are. And it's all, so like you said, it's become sort of a more family-oriented thing where we all want to go watch the superhero movie because we all know these characters and it looks good and it's going to be amazing and we all like it.
Right. I think there's definitely something to say for my fallback theory here about pop culture and us as a society in general experiencing an infantilization. Where kind of in the past you were expected and even forced to quote unquote grow up at a certain point in your life. And I just think over time that has eroded to where we're at now, where it basically never has to happen. And I'm sure the internet is part of that because it kind of changed the landscape of the traditional way to earn a living for your family even and way to interact with each other. And I mean, you can make a career now and people have and people still do out of, you know, staying with those interests for their whole life. you know, reviews and, you know, pop culture websites, all these kinds of things.
So it's interesting that you talk about how people, like, you know, in the past were sort of maybe pressured, I don't want to say forced, but pressured by sort of societal norms to sort of leave things behind.
Right.
But I don't think there was any I don't think there's any way you can look at that and say that that's automatically a good thing, you know? There's a whole generation of men who spent all their time out of the house, you know?
Right.
So, you know, because they're the main breadwinner, and then there's bowling league, and then there's poker night, and then, you know, they were, like, encouraged to do these things that men do, pulled them away from their family. And it's interesting that maybe these sort of things that would sort of be considered less adultish actually help you stay more connected to your family in a way. And then the other point that I was going to make, when you talk about people have monetized nerddom or fandom, I think that's fair. But the point that I was trying to make about leading a productive adult life is that you can be interested in these things and still go teach fifth grade. You can be interested in these things and still go sell car insurance. You know, like, you can do sort of the normal everyday things. But that doesn't mean that you have to not be interested in the things that you like.
Shit, these things will probably help you teach fifth grade.
It might be. Well, that's definitely true. That's definitely true. I think there's also a thing where, again, it comes back to the internet. I think maybe in the early days of the internet, like, the small pockets of people who sort of stubbornly hung on to these things that they enjoyed into adulthood.
Yeah.
It made it easier to find the other individual pockets of people spread out.
Absolutely.
And the more those connections got made, the more other people would maybe notice it and think, man, I didn't have to, you know, stop watching cartoons. I didn't have to stop caring about whatever it is I cared about. Like,
sell all my toys at the garage.
Yeah, there. Yeah, I'm guilty of that. you know, they saw others sort of being able to be interested and still be adults by any conceivable measure, right, other than sort of, you know, the stereotype that you apply to somebody. So I think maybe that did help. It helped sort of, even if you're not officially part of a network, you don't have to be a part of an internet forum. You don't have to have, you know what I mean?
Right.
You just see it happening, and so you become more comfortable with it in yourself.
For sure. It would take an entire separate episode to probably psychoanalyze my mental and emotional development. But that process of leaving childhood behind just never seemed to happen really for me. So I can attest to having those feelings in the early days of the internet and finding, like, the odd forum or website devoted specifically to, you know, 80s nostalgia and a lot of the things we talk about on this podcast. And we're talking like 2001, 2002, you know, where I had spotty access to the internet before that. But that's when I really started to go down rabbit holes and be like, wow, there's other people out here who still remember this thing like I do and still, you know, wonder about it and still want to know more. And it's definitely a nice feeling when you find something like that.
Yeah, and I think that's part of how it happened, how more people became connected to it. I think, unfortunately, there's been a backlash where people who, you know, like I said before, it's that tribalism thing where it's like, well, you're not really a nerd because, you know, you wear a tie to work. Well,
right.
It's like, well, it's just their job, you know, they got to wear a tie. It doesn't mean they're not interested in something that you're interested in.
I think it's also the what we're seeing now is that thing that always happens whenever there is kind of a cultural shift or a widespread movement or pattern of behavior where, you know, when the pendulum swings from one side to the other, it overshoots the middle. And
always,
you know, here we are in the midst of everything all nerd all the time in a lot of ways.
I think, like, the number one, like, sort of illustrator of that point is the Big Bang Theory TV show.
Yeah, I've seen that come up in a lot of these articles,
actually. That's sort of the most sort of capitalized thing to sort of grab onto nerd culture or, you know, geek culture or whatever.
Yeah.
So, like, hey, you're, you know, this is a show about you. It's not really.
No.
There's a lot of, I mean, every once in a while that show will spit out a funny joke, but so much of it is packaged. It's like any sitcom, really. It's like any network show. It's prepackaged to go to a really large audience. But I think, on one hand, it's like, it's kind of cool that it got made.
Right.
That somebody was able to pitch this and somebody else said, yes, we'll do this. And it's cool that it's been so successful. but its actual depiction of people is very archetypal, and I don't think it really helps sort of illustrate our point that anybody can be interested in these things without being this archetype of social inability.
Yeah, it's basically the, you know, it's, I guess, a billion sitcoms have this format, but it's basically Friends, but for very specifically stereotyped nerd, traditional nerdy characters.
Absolutely. And the occasional jock character will come in and be a complete archetype of that.
Right.
Like, there's not really anybody on the show that, you know, lives between those. There's nobody in the middle of their Venn diagram.
I think it's because TV is still, in many ways, clinging to outdated models. So, like, we might have moved away from that in society, but the way they package entertainment, at least on a smaller screen TV level, seems to be kind of using that old format, especially on a traditional network. I think they're the final last adopters of anything new.
Well, and especially on a sort of traditional laugh tracked,
yeah,
you know, half hour sitcom. Because I would say that a lot of TV has really evolved beyond that. When you look at high productions on shows, you know, on HBO or Stars or Showtime, you know, these kind of high concept TV shows and Netflix as well. But yeah, the networks, it always seems a little bit more sterilized and,
right,
you know, like it's like assembly line TV show making. You know, we need this archetype, so we go to this box and we pull it out. And we pull,
yeah,
out this. We're going to make a cop show. It's like, okay, well, we get out the cop show box.
Yeah, exactly.
You take,
yeah,
out the pieces that you want.
This has to be the nerd show.
You've made a new cop show.
Yeah.
You've made a new legal procedural show. You know, so the network TV, I think, is still subject to those tendencies. But I do think TV, maybe outside of that system, is evolving for the better.
Yeah, at some point, they're not going to be able to resist the trend, the growing trend seen on those networks. I guess they're networks, but they're kind of premium networks that you mentioned. You know, they're, especially Netflix, has absolutely changed the game. And, you know, I can't imagine it being too much longer to where, you know, the big four have to look at that and say, either we're going to have to follow suit or we're done.
The other thing I think is in terms of the formats that they follow is that, like, the regular broadcast networks still lean on this idea that a season is like 20 or 30 episodes of a show. And that is so much content to try to get out that the quality is just going to suffer. It's going to be, you got to thin it out. You know, stories are going to be, yeah, repetitive. I think a lot of, again, higher production shows, they're able to focus on a story in a much more concise way. You know, most of the really successful high concept TV shows on cable and on, you know, streaming, Stranger Things, Game of Thrones, you know, what have you, they're telling their stories in, like, you know, 10, 12, 13 episodes.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, network TV, they still grind through these, like, it's like insanity. You don't need 20-something episodes of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. per season. I mean, I know it's a lot of content, so the show can live on in syndication and reruns and DVD sales, right, and whatever. But, it, you know, the storytelling definitely suffers when you try to spread it out over that much time.
Well, I think that has to, I think certain formats and types of shows can weather that more than others. And they probably need to be more careful when selecting what to put on in that format. But I think the reason that persists is that people aren't looking to things like Stranger Things as their daily driver, so to speak, what they come home from work and faithfully put on every week or whatever. Stranger Things is like the seasonal spice on top of their...
that is true.
You know, their bland cheese pizza.
I definitely make that choice sometimes, you know.
Oh, yeah.
We have like a buildup of shows on our DVR, or maybe there's a couple shows on Netflix that we know we want to watch at some point. But sometimes, you know, at home, me and my wife will make the decision what we watch based on what is our emotional commitment to this show right now.
Right.
And there are some shows that just take a lot less emotional commitment. You can just kind of have it on and you know what to expect and it's safe. And there's other shows that you sort of have to be willing to be invested because everything's going to be important. Because of that concise, tight storytelling, it causes you to have to sort of be more engaged with it.
Yeah.
And other shows, sometimes, again, the safe sort of diluted network shows, don't always require that. And sometimes, you know, at the end of a day, you don't really want to put your emotion into it.
That's true.
And you just kind of put it on. So I've definitely, so to be fair, I definitely have made viewing choices probably based on that sort of, you know, thought process.
I've had, I had a similar discussion one time with one of my ex-girlfriend's relatives who, her occupation was something in pharmaceutical sales. And, you know, I've always been pretty vocal about my distaste for things like what MTV has become in terms of the types of reality shows that they always put on, or things like what American Idol became and that type of thing. And this subject came up at a dinner one time, and she was the first one I ever encountered to kind of make a similar point to what you're saying, where she was like, you know, I deal with all these numbers and formulas and whatever else all day long, and when I come home, I just want to put on something stupid and tune my brain out. So I really couldn't, you know, fault her for that.
Right. Yeah.
As much as, and maybe that just speaks to the fact that I'm really not very engaged during my work day. And maybe I'm lucky in that way. I kind of spend most of my time on autopilot. So when I'm watching entertainment, I want it to hold my interest, I guess.
Yeah, I feel like I kind of have to be like, at least sort of like superficially enthusiastic all day long. Right. And it's not really my nature, so it does get a little bit, it's a little bit funny that I found myself in the career that I find myself, which is working with young kids. I like kids, but you walk in, you gotta be like, hey, everybody! Right. And then that keeps on for 8 more hours, and so that gets a little bit tiring.
You've gotta be live and in person, you know, Mr. Rogers or something, Captain Kangaroo all day, every day.
Yeah, gotta be on, man.
Although I suppose it helps you maintain your connection to your nostalgic interests of the days past.
It's definitely true. Although I am guilty of going through stages in my life where I left things behind. You know, I did sell toys at garage sales, and, you know, I did sort of, you know, most of the time I think I was coming at it from this like weird sense of responsibility. Like, well, I can't be interested in all these things. That puts too much pressure on my parents to buy me all the cool stuff. You know, these kind of thoughts would go through my head even as a kid. So I would try to like focus on little things at a time. So I don't know, but I'm definitely guilty of sort of being like, well, it's time for me to move on from this and move on to the next thing.
Right.
When really maybe what you should do sometimes is just put one thing aside because you might come back to it later.
Yeah.
And that's definitely true in my current sort of iteration of myself, where I have a lot of different interests and hobbies, and I'll frustrate myself by staying away from one thing for so long. But I just kind of have to live with it, because if I force myself to stay on it, I would get sick of it and get bored with it. I got to let myself move around a little bit. I'm getting off track, so I'll just shut up starting now.
So does that imply that the answer to the larger question of how nerd-related topics and interests rose to prominence in movies and culture in general, does that mean that we've all just learned to be less hasty in putting aside our interests and sort of maybe just keep them around but put them in the background instead of getting rid of them entirely?
Maybe. Just a more willingness to sort of come back to it if you want to. I mean, that's the thing that I think it comes down to, just from like my personal opinion of how people should be. It's just like, be interested in what you want to be interested in. You know, if you lose interest, put it aside. Maybe you'll come back to it later. That's how I'm doing things now, anyway. And I feel like it's been good for me. So, I mean, that's just kind of my general opinion. I mean, it could be different for everybody, I guess. But I think you're right. People are just more willing to sort of come back to it if they want to, but not be forced to give it up. There's people who say, man, I miss doing that. You don't have to not do it anymore.
Right. Like, it's still there.
Yeah, it exists.
And it's more preserved now than at any point in history because of kind of decades of people being told they can't anymore. And I think, you know, it probably just reached a point where it came to a head and people kind of started pushing back.
Yeah, I think that's totally fair.
Take it from me, the kid who didn't sell anything at a garage sale, but instead bought things other people were selling. Yeah, you don't ever really have to leave, even if your reason for staying is crippling lack of emotional progress.
We're not going to that deep a dive here today. I'm not emotionally prepared for that.
You just want to turn your brain off. I'm sorry.
That's right.
Well, it's my half of this podcast reflects my entertainment proclivities, and your half, I suppose, reflects yours. There's a little something for everybody, just like the nerd movies of 2018.
I suppose so. Yeah, movies are, it's interesting that, like, generally, sometimes people consider the movie industry down, but in terms of pop culture, man, it dominates.
Yeah.
You know, maybe there's, like, a capitalistic negative in there somewhere, you know, big blockbusters, or movies don't mean as much, the storytelling's not as good, but that might be true in some cases, but I think in a lot of cases, they're getting, Hollywood's getting pretty good at making big movies that are also really good.
It's also interesting that movies...
To say nothing of the Michael Bay Transformers movies.
It's interesting that movies can dominate now when we're at a time where they've never been more expensive or, you know...
Or faced more competition from other media.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just harder and harder now to justify taking everybody to go see a movie than it ever has been. I mean, the whole point of a movie and then the reason they became so popular initially, or part of it, is that, you know, it was fairly cheap entertainment. It was, you could go out for the night and, you know, you can get your concessions and you sit there and watch the feature, and, you know, it wasn't going to really kind of burn a hole in your wallet to do it. But now you kind of have to decide, do you want to go to the movie or do you want to go to dinner? It's not dinner and a movie. It's dinner or a movie.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's definitely true. But yeah, you know, and so there's a thing where, like, you know, ticket sales are down, but the money's up because the prices right. are so much more. But the imagery of pop culture and fandom is still based on the imagery of movies, you know. The Avengers, for instance, because that's what we're talking about. That was sort of the catalyst for this conversation. The Avengers have always existed, or at least they've existed for a long time. The movies start getting made. So the imagery that you see that has Avengers merchandise isn't always the movie Avengers. It could be like an animated series or whatever it is.
Right.
But you wouldn't have seen it before the movies. So the movie still is the central node for this explosion of sort of more widely socially accepted fandom. And I don't know if we've even come close to answering the question of why that is, but I think we've definitely sort of shown that it is.
Oh yeah, it definitely is, and it's definitely not changing anytime soon. But it's certainly interesting to kind of try to track the journey that got us here as a society and maybe consider, just as you can kind of hit the pause button on your interests to come back later, maybe you can also hit the pause button on cultural fervor to examine where you should go from here. So I think now it's time for us to hit the pause button on this discussion and surely revisit it later when the next form of this phenomenon takes shape. As always, I've been your friend Claude.
And I am just Jamie.
And we will see you later.
Later.
Nerd Bomber Podcast is a Ghost Factory Internet production brought to you by the WHAM Network.